Well, folks, it's time again for another edition of Valley Edition. It's my great pleasure to welcome on this momentous occasion, the 20th of January, 2017, Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
And I welcome Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Morning, Mike.
And I welcome on the phone Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
So, it's hard not to at least talk a little bit about a significant event, the ascension of the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. He is officially, as we are doing this show, the President of the United States. The inaugural process came to completion, the major point, which was that the Supreme Court Chief Justice gave the opportunity to Mr. Trump to put his hand on two Bibles and swear the oath and become the 45th president. I caught parts of it. I understand that perhaps others caught parts of it. Let's start with Zaz, since you're at home there. What's your impression at this early stage of just the pure fact of the inauguration as it happened?
My impression from the home office, I watched the inauguration with my elementary age daughters because, I told them it was a moment in history, which it certainly was. There are a lot of Alaskans in D.C. today, some for the inauguration and some for protests. My impression, I don't know how much my personal impression really matters, but certainly this was a much more of a bright line in this transition than sometimes there is, even when a Republican gives way to a Democrat or vice versa. We had that line and then plus just a completely different culture, political culture, coming into the White House. The speech that now President Trump gave, the reviews that I've seen so far, and I think it's pretty obvious, it felt like a campaign speech in some ways, and I think the tagline probably was America First, that we are, that the president would like to take us back in the direction of less of a world government and more of an isolated one, I suppose. That remains to be seen how that will kind of translate. I did hear some economic analysis from people on both sides of the aisle, economists on both sides of the aisle, and it seemed like the one unifying factor in their analysis was that they really weren't certain how the president's, at this point, stated policies will really benefit the people he has talked about wanting to help. People in there's one economist mentioned a place called Reading, Pennsylvania, where I think I've been, and it looks like hell. It's a small town. All the windows are boarded up. Apparently, heroin there has just devastated the place. And it's right now it's not clear how the president's policies would benefit a place like that. But clearly he is tapping into. And needs to address the fact that even though he is coming into, the president's statements about, he stood up there and criticized the most recent Obama administration, but he is coming into a much, much healthier economy than former President Obama came into. That said, he is coming into an economy that has left people behind, despite the unemployment rate being better than it's been in how many years. There are a lot of people that still need to find gainful employment. So,
well, I was struck by a little bit of the visual that I had of people's faces. Looking at three former presidents up there, whom in variety of ways had their own difficulties, things to deal with, and did that variously. But my impression was that the three of them could talk to one another as the transition occurred and afterwards, and they were there. I'm not sure that's what I'm picking up from Mr. Trump. He has pressed this as being a break. And I think it's as he continues on, I think that point made about when will the campaign be over? Some people would suggest it'll never be over because this is what he does. He campaigns, and that's part of it. But Mark, any comments here?
No, I think these are all really good observations. Zaz had a good summation of the ceremony. I saw it. I thought, you know, I kept thinking this sounds like he's still in campaign mode. I didn't really hear any, you know, a reach out to all Americans. There were a couple of statements that he, you know, that seemed to me sort of like a lip service to the idea of unifying the country. I think he knows it's out there, but he did not spend a lot of time talking about it. It seemed to me almost as if he said it just because he knew he had to. I didn't sense any real substance or, you know, core belief there. So yeah, that was my whole takeaway from it. I wanted to feel more. I wanted to feel better. I wanted to feel like this was really an event for everyone, and I did not.
Mm-hmm. Terry?
Well, I didn't watch it. It just wasn't something I could move myself to do this morning. But it kind of just those are all been good comments. But I think a lot of times it's not even the goal, where you're going. It's who you bring along with you and how you get there that really matters most. And when you just sort of start your presidency with more campaign rhetoric, that's not a good sign. It's not a unifying sign. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny. It's not I think everybody had looked forward to there being less noise in the room. But I don't think that's going to happen. I do think it's going to be a wake-up call for a lot of people to pay attention. I mean, I think there are probably some people that even if they voted for who was sworn in today are, you know, kind of betting on him as, you know, Zaz pointed out, there are some communities that really are hinging what he does and making their communities better. And I hope for their sake it does, but I'm not in the optimistic camp at this point. It is what it is. It's the tool in toolbox. And I just hope that he gets the scrutiny that he deserves and that, people are paying attention and understand that this is serious stuff. And when you elect somebody who doesn't have any governing experience, it sounds great to say, let's shake things up and let's get people in there to run it like a business. But you don't have to know what's going on to very closely to know that running a democracy is not like running a 7-Eleven. It's a much different thing. And he's already appointed some people with lack in depth and experience to run departments. And some of the information that's coming out from reputable reporters, it's pretty scary. So we'll see what happens.
And I think the transition period, which is one of those time frames that's often looked at to get some sense of what's going to come afterwards, has been muddled, if you will. There are all kinds of reports that it, you know, where's Chris Christie when you need him? I mean,
his wife wouldn't let him move to D.C. apparently.
Well, whatever the situation, and Chris Christie has apparently, I mean, he has got some baggage, absolutely, but apparently he may have been one of the people that actually could understand what it takes to do a transition. And at this point, there are all kinds of reports coming in about just not being ready, not having people in place. And I keep thinking, knowing about some organizations, I've worked in D.C. for a bit myself, that it's one thing to be looking at the person who's going to be the commissioner, the director, the cabinet member. But then you start walking on down. And whether it's in the White House or anywhere else, there are people who are in charge of answering the phone and directing their gatekeepers in one way or the other. There are people that know who to call when you have a question about something. And those people are extremely important. It's a very complex system that we have. It's not going to go away. And if you can't understand who it is that is the important person to call to do this, it can make whatever your intention go awry. So I'm looking to see how quickly the fill-in happens and what happens, probably starting on Monday. There's going to be continuing celebration and activities all through this week. But maybe this is a good point to segue, because I understood that there were going to be a large number of groups that would be protesting in one way or the other at the inauguration. But tomorrow is the big day. The reports that I have seen suggest somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 people coming to Washington, D.C. to march. And there are similar marches occurring in some 600-odd places around the country, including both Palmer, downtown Palmer, as well as Anchorage. Terry, do you have any information about those?
No, I've been corresponding with a few people that are there, so I hope we have some reports. But, yeah, I think this is a great statement. If anything's going to be kind of unifying, I think that march will be unifying. And I'll be watching and participating like lots of other people.
Right, right. Well,
and there are protests happening today. There have been reports of, you know, thousands of people in peaceful protest, but a number of people in not peaceful protest. And that there have been a few blocks from the inauguration, there were windows broken at the Bank of America and Starbucks. There have been about 100 people arrested, a couple police officers injured. So it's not all peaceful protest. And that's certainly going to get a lot of headlines before tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I was struck by a piece that was done, I think the New York Times covered it pretty well, pointing out that when we look back at this one, some people will want to run the numbers. And one of the numbers is how many people were actually there. And these days, there are satellites available to do pretty accurate counting and density things. They had a great picture looking back at Lincoln's inauguration and pointing out that there were probably, 7,500 or so people there, just doing the analysis from the photos that were available at that time. And that's been one of the things that, of course, has dogged campaigns most recently. When someone says, well, I had a large crowd, what does that mean? Was it really large? Was it not? But these figures should be emerging. And I know that for the Obama inauguration, number one, that was a huge number. I believe it may have been a record number, 1.8 million people around for that. They tend to be more in the million level at other times. And we'll see how that plays out. And, of course, I think there are people that are particularly interested in the numbers as a show of whatever, opposition, if you will.
Popular support in this case.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. that kind of thing.
Or lack of, yeah.
Yeah. So here on Saturday, both in Anchorage and Palmer and other places, there will be marches as well. But local government marches on as well. And Terry was able to listen to most of the school board meeting that happened this week. And we were able to watch as the legislature was sworn in Juneau. And there seems to be an interesting connection between those two events, in part because the school district, without all the information they would like to have, has to come up with a budget. And the people down in Juneau have to eventually come up with a budget as well. And these are, I think the big thing about the local piece is that the school board is making every effort to share their thinking and some of the things that they're seeing projected. Terry, do you want to summarize a bit about that?
So, yeah, it was a regularly scheduled meeting, but it was a very full house, I'm told, and that was because one of the issues on the agenda was not only Luke Falp, who gave a pretty comprehensive overview of the challenges that the district is going to be under to cut some $10 million off their existing budget to pass a balanced budget for next year. And of course, I think it's important that everybody understand that the school budget, school district is the first one that has to pass their budget. They have to, before May 1, I think, or maybe it's April 1, I can't remember the date now, they have to submit a balanced budget to the assembly, who has to then do their balanced budget before the legislature. And a lot of funding, in fact, the bulk of funding comes from, for the school district, comes from the state. And so there's a lot of unknowns. So what they were trying to do was roll out some options, and they did it in a pretty comprehensive way. It's loaded on the school district website, all the information on it, sort of what is, what if we close schools, what if we cut down some extracurricular activities, not so much about that. But the big one was, what if we go and do what we did a few years ago and then undid, and that's lay off all the custodians, 122, and some nutrition services. And what the agenda item was to ask the school board, because that is the biggest savings that they found, the opportunity to go out and put a an RFP out, request for proposal on who might bid on something like that and what the savings are. They've estimated to be somewhere between, I think, 1.4 million up to almost 4 million, but they don't know. So it was a good discussion. I think there are some questions that could have maybe been asked that weren't asked, but there is some time to do that. This is the introduction of it. And even if the school board does pass it the next time, they would still have to come back and ask the okay to go ahead and do it. And but if it all goes through, that could happen as early as July. So there was good testimony there. I think there's a lot more questioning to be done. I think there's some numbers that might be a little squishy in there. But it should get the attention of a few people, that's for sure. And that's what they want. Now, whether that will move the needle on the borough, who isn't up to the cap, nearly up to the cap in taxing to pay for the district. They haven't, they're still at 2009 property tax levies. They haven't raised the property tax since 2009. Of course, you know, your property values have probably gone up, and your RSAs and your SAs and stuff has gone up. So people have probably seen their property tax go up. But as far as the mill rate, hasn't changed since 2009. I don't know about you, but everything in my house has gone up since then. And whether even doing all that will move the needle on the borough or move the needle, who is also having its own budgeting problems. But more importantly to me, will this even move the needle on the legislature? Because it's not an election year, and it seems to me that every time they move the needle, they just move the goalpost. And so I'm not very confident this is the right way to go, but it certainly should garner some attention for people to put some pressure on the right people to do something.
Has there been any talk at all about how the outsourcing worked or not? The first time, I was kind of amazed. I saw a story on, I think, Channel 2 News a couple nights ago. There was no mention that this had even been tried before. Has that been absent from the discussion?
Well, the discussion with the school board and administration was, it was absent. There wasn't any hard numbers on what that cost were, which I think it should be part of the discussion. There was some testimony about that, on how bad that worked as far as the people that it affected. And I think you're right. I think the cost of, and I think Member Rutherford did make a point that we, you know, this is a great presentation. There's clearly a lot of work that went into it, but she had some concerns about that thing, about how are we including all the costs of doing that, because it was tried and failed, and it did have some costs, and maybe that's the question they should be asking, because they sold all their equipment to the vendor, when they went back and brought those employees back into the bargaining units. It also, they had to rebuy all of that stuff. They had to rehire everybody. There were HR costs. So I think those hard numbers need to come. And also, I wonder what it's going to do to their health insurance. If you take 122 people just from one division off your health insurance, it would seem to me the trust is going to look at that and say, are we just shifting costs? That seems to be what we're doing here, is we're just shifting costs at every level instead of really taking a hard look at what's going to solve the question.
Well, what you have done, Terry, is raise a lot of questions that point clearly at the last experience. And I would suspect that someone will ask that of the school board. And one would hope that there would be a comparison in the next presentation that will look at that.
Well, I think that's one of it. But part of it is what we should be asking our legislators. And we should be looking at solutions. If you're going to say it's a bad idea, what is your solution? How do you backfill a $10 million deficit? Do they have too much in their operating, you know, some people refer to it their slush fund, some $28 million? Is there other places that we can cut? And, you know, as far as administration, what's your idea for a funding formula? If it's not working the way they're doing it, what is their idea to the legislature to make it better? So I think that should be part of the conversation, too.
I know there was a report about the ongoing presentations in Juneau. One, in fact, that probably was similar to the presentation that was done here, where a number of administration people talked about the deficit and the proposals and so on. A similar presentation was given at Centennial Hall in Juneau, and the people that attended tended to be from the majority in the House, primarily Democrats, a couple of people from the other party there, in a various set of reasons given for not attending. But I guess I'm wondering if those what appeared to be almost offhand comments about something like, say, wait for the next governor or whatever, those kinds of things don't portend well for an aggressive stance of sitting down and saying, okay, let's get at this. Let's say if the governor has a proposal we don't like, here's our other one, and let's sit down and talk to it right now. So there still seems to be pessimism in the air about, and I think, Terry, you may be right, remembering that this is a two-year legislature, and most people are not going to be up for election next year. But the following year, that's another story. I also think that there are some very interesting things happening with the switch from in the House in particular from a Republican majority to a coalition majority. Mark, do I understand correctly that if you're in the majority, you get more staff than if you're in the minority?
That is how it's been traditionally and is still the case. I know there was talk pre-session of cutting staff on both sides, but I believe they went back to what has been the typical staffing level for years. And yes, folks in the majority get more staff people than.
And if you're on a committee, if you're a committee chair, you get extra too, right?
Yes.
Right. So if you've come in and you've been heading toward the, for example, the House, and you happen to be a Republican and the majority had been Republican, but now it's switched, you suddenly have to do with less. And that's an interesting question of what kind of difference that makes if you have additional staff to help with the work that you're doing. In addition, of course, being in a majority position and chairing and having somewhat more control of the flow of events. Well, there's one last topic, just touch upon it because it popped up and I thought it grabbed a lot of people's attention, and that was the resignation of Bill Gamble as head of the emergency services. He's been there. He's been there for 2 years, and from all respects, information that I have, he's done a pretty good job. But of course, he's been involved with fire departments and so on for many years, and he's moving on. The question's being asked, of course. Well, who's going to follow and take over things? But secondly, is he leaving because of the reluctance on the part of the borough and the assembly to provide some of the staffing, which he suggests is woefully inadequate? Any comment, Zaz?
Yeah, I think that a few things probably factored into his decision to resign, and he did tell me, and I think other people as well, that I think this is heartfelt. I know we all hear, I'm leaving to spend more time with my family, but. Bill was a full-time air traffic controller when he became Big Lake chief and then acting Meadow Lake chief and then merged those two departments. And so, he said he really didn't see his his daughter grow up, and his son was, you know, very young. And it sounds as if now there's this combination of an opportunity, a mysterious business opportunity with his daughter, who's 26 now and has a marketing master, a master's in marketing. And, you know, he didn't say this, but, you know, you don't, unless it's a really, really appealing business proposition, you don't leave a job that you're 100% happy with and feel 100% supported in. And, you know, he's been, whenever Bill would stand up and make presentations at Assembly, you know, he was asking for a lot and making it pretty clear that there was a significant gap between how the Assembly was choosing to fund emergency services in the borough and how it needed to be funded, especially to make up for the gap between what's available and the growth that we're still experiencing. You know, and his point was that basically to respond to fires and ambulance calls and rescue calls with a mostly paid on-call force just isn't tenable anymore, plus aging equipment, plus outdated radio system. It's just, it's time to grow up and turn into more of a modern, you know, firefighting and medical force. And we aren't there. There's, I mean, there's great responders, but they are not supported, he would say, by the borough in the way they should be. And plus the cap, the 29.9-hour cap, is getting in the way as well.
Yep.
So is there any indication who will take over? Will they bring fresh eyes or think someone will be promoted or...
I don't know. I mean, I've heard that there are some internal candidates. I guess there always are. And Bill certainly was an internal candidate. I mean, he was selected by John Moosey without an external process. Mm-hmm. So I think this time they advertised his job before they sent out a press release.
Oh, my gosh.
So I guess that would indicate they're looking.
Okay.
And is it up to Moosey to hire?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is Moosey's sole discretion, right?
To hire the DES position, I believe so. I mean, the Assembly can always pitch in terms of their feedback, but yeah.
It makes you kind of wonder if they had gone through the process last time. You know, they may have a candidate already ready, even if ultimately I think Bill is a great guy, they'd have a go-to list. So that's another indication of just pushing the problem down the road.
Yeah, it's going to take a special person, you know, to do that job now.
Mm-hmm. Is there anyone on the inside that you see that you think could be a front runner? How about a person like Casey Cook?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, Casey or Ken Barkley is the, you know, second in command at DES. And I haven't heard that Ken is just stepping in on a permanent basis anyway. Casey, I mean, I don't know. He's juggling a lot. He's got, you know, he and his wife now own the Grape Tap. I don't know that's the administrative side of the director job is thankless. You know, Dennis Brodigan was, and Dennis is full disclosure, a friend of mine. I play in the concert band with Dennis, but, he had spent a long time in the private sector. I think he kind of had the bureaucracy side of things down. He's a good people person, and he still, you know, he couldn't survive in that department after certain things started to change. I don't know. I don't know if Casey would want that job, honestly.
I wonder. I wonder. It sounds to me like you kind of indicated it early, is that they are at that crux. They have to decide which way they want to be. Do they want to go along the same line of just putting a Band-Aid on things, which is ironic since they're EMS, are they going to really make a structural change in the way they do things, which is not going to be cheap in a time when money is short. So that's
and that's something that Dennis Brodigan was recommending. I mean, Bill is not the first person to come into that department and say, we need more full-time responders, and we need to pay them and give them benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have surfaced another issue, which will be discussed at great length, but we have run out of time. So I want to thank Zaz Hollander for being on the phone there. Thank you, Zaz.
Yeah, you're welcome, Mike.
And thank you, Terry Snyder, for being in the room here where it's warm.
You're welcome, Mike.
And thank you, Mark Kelsey, for also being here.
Good discussion. Happy to be part of it.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week for another edition of Valley Edition.